to figure out where we call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Today we're waiting for a fiscal on Senate Bill 40, so we're going to have a conversation first about Senate Bill 115. So I will open a work session on Senate Bill 115. Welcome, Mazin.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Senate Bill 115 came in front of you a while ago. I'll tell you, March 30th, I believe, February 16th. And at that time, when we looked at it, it needed amendments and change in language, primarily to allow for the other types of debt obligations to have its first call, if you will, on revenues before these bonds, new bonds, no revenue bonds by the Oregon University Systems are issued. It seems like we've submitted for an amendment, and you have the dash 2 in front of you. However, it seems like the dash 2 at this time does not necessarily hit the bullseye, if you will, kind of recall the debt. I think they will, the Oregon University System and the Treasury Office would probably talk to you about the requirement. I think the requirement that they see the same language that would satisfy the requirements here would be in Senate Bill 242. That's the bill that deals with all the university system type of issues on the finance and other stuff. So that language might be lifted from that bill into this one if we go with, a dash 3 by then.
Okay.
But they would probably fill you in, although I was asking Mike and both Mikes, I guess, from both university and treasurer, but the letter that there is a requirement for this new bond to be subservient or below the COPs, the Certificate of Participation. And that kind of seems a little strange, since the Certificate of Participations usually don't have the higher call on revenue ahead of bond types, which almost rendered the bond types kind of useless or has no precedence.
Well, we're not going to be using that many COPs anyway with the changes that we made in the bonding statute, correct?
That's my impression. Although the COPs would still have their use, I mean, we're not canceling them. But the COPs would probably, in their definition, should not have that much hierarchy on the call for revenue. But if they have that ahead of those bonds, that kind of diminishes the importance of these bonds.
Correct. And we'll ask them to go into that when they come up. So Michael and whoever Mike. You want to bring up with you.
Mike.
Should we get one Michael or two?
Two.
Why take one Mike when you can have two?
Maybe the two Mikes have two Mikes.
Two Mikes for the two Mikes.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Silvandio from the Office of the State Treasurer. What Mazin described was, I think, precisely correct. We do want to see the language from Senate Bill 242 put in here in lieu of the language that describes what needs to be pledged above what in terms of the obligations of the university system. The concern around the COPs, though, I want to clarify that applies to COPs that have already been set up and to which there is already a pledge of revenue coming in to pay for those.
So basically, this anything issued under this system would be senior to new COPs, but would be junior to existing COPs?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I think that would, I don't want to speak out of school, but I think that would depend on the, that would depend on how they were set up prospectively. But the key element here that we want to protect is that existing COPs aren't impaired through this statute.
Okay.
Because in plain English, no one would, in their right mind, would lend to us if they knew that we had a habit of simply turning around and subordinating their debt to something else when we felt like it, which we do not do.
Okay. Nazem, does that address your concern about it?
I think the existing COPs probably need to be clear that it's not future COPs, because otherwise, same issue.
Yeah, maybe we could find out some more about that and see how that would shake out, because I think he makes a good point that you're talking about a bond versus a COP, because right now the COPs are, if you have an existing bond and an existing COP, the COP is junior to the bond, correct?
COPs does not usually have any precedence in, actually. There is no guarantee for payment in general.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, if I may interject, we to any of our underwriters or potential underwriters that are listening to this hearing, we certainly do treat that as if we have an obligation.
Well, but well,
it's implicit obligation, though. Yeah. That's not a legal obligation.
But that obligation would, I guess what I'm concerned about is if the COPs are put out there without an actual official guarantee, but it's implicit, I think we'd have to think very carefully before we change that. In other words, we don't want to install a specific guarantee. That's a separate policy question.
Right.
And Chair Burdick, I think that we would have no objection looking at putting up sideboards on that to clarify what the precedence is moving forward.
Mike? May I? Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I think the...
Can you identify...
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. My name is Mike Green. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration and Controller for the University System. The language here really is intended to do one thing, and that is to ensure that when and if the Chancellor, under the authority of the legislature, chooses to ask the Treasurer to issue revenue bonds, that the revenues that are set aside, that are pledged to pay those bonds, that first out of our revenues there is reserved an amount to pay those outstanding obligations that have already been issued. So that's what we're talking about here, is really to say, okay, the university system has a certain level of revenues here that it could pledge for these revenue bonds, but it first has to set aside an amount to pay off the existing debt outstanding before it can then pledge additional revenues. And that's all this is really doing. It's not really trying to say that a certain debt obligation has a higher standing than other debt obligations. It's more of a budgetary protecting the GO bonds that have already been outstanding that the Treasurer has issued for higher ed. So that's all this is really trying to do here.
Okay, well, that's different than changing the
yes
category.
And I think the language, in 242 basically says exactly what I said there. Before pledging revenues for these revenue bonds, the Chancellor first has to set aside sufficient revenues for those outstanding obligations.
Okay. I guess I would have thought that would already be assumed, but for any bonding, yeah. Okay. Other questions from the committee? Our education committee members have any comments on that?
Well, Madam Chair, I was just why we didn't do this earlier, I guess would be my first question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the request, to my understanding, was put through to Legislative Council to do just that, and I think that there has been a minor disagreement somewhere along the line, but the language in 242 is what the Treasury would would very much like to see, or if we take a look at prospective issues. But to be frank, we were not satisfied with the amendments as they came out of Legislative Council.
Okay. Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your reference to amendments are the dash twos?
Yes.
And the inarticulate crafting of language, would that be line 7, 8, 9, and 10 on page 1 of the dash twos?
Yep. Where are you, Senator Morris?
Page dash two.
Okay, on the first page?
Yes. Or if it's not, could you direct us to the language that it is not adequate?
I think it might be section 4. Is that what you're...
Right.
Yes.
The original bill.
No, that's not it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the concern is that the language does not exist in the amendment. There's clearly provisions for setting aside monies for paying debt service without the provisions in 242 that require that before those pledges are made, the sufficient funds to pay existing obligations are provided for. So it's... I would say that that's more an omission than an artful draft.
Okay. All right. Other questions? We'll just wait to or any other comments from either of you.
I just would echo my colleague's comment. We did request those amendments be drafted to be identical to 242, and I don't really know where that didn't happen. I don't know the process that well, but we were asking for that. So.
Okay, well, you have a request in to fix it, right? Do you have any sense of when those will be ready?
Madam Chair, I do not.
When did the request go in?
Madam Chair, this document got to us this morning, so the request has been sent through the Department of Justice today.
Okay. This is dated March 17th.
Madam Chair, the dash two is a committee amendment, so we requested it, and we could, now that we know what is lacking out of this, I guess, we could make a committee amendment as well for it.
Okay, well, why don't you work with the Treasurer in whichever way is fastest. Let's do it, because we're running out of time.
And Madam Chair, if I may also put on the record that we think Senate Bill 242 came out very nice, and if the committee sees fit to make that a substitute for Senate Bill 115, then we think that would just be a lovely idea.
So wait a second. Are you saying that everything in 115 is in 242?
That is my understanding.
Then why are we even talking about this? In case 242 doesn't make it, or what?
242.
That's the higher ed.
Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, I understand it's a plan B, so to speak, in case 242 doesn't make it, as you said.
Oh, okay. Well, let's get our amendment, and then we'll just hang on to this for a while until we see what happens. I didn't understand that was a one-for-one substitution. 242 was so long ago. All right. Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 115. Any sign of a fiscal? Okay. We'll roll over Senate Bill 40 to Wednesday. I think we're going to... Do the chances look good that we would get it in the next 20 minutes or so?
Fiscal was working on it when I spoke to them an hour or so ago. So have at the time.
Okay, we're going to recess for 10 minutes, and we'll come back. we will reconvene the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 40. Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. With Senate Bill 40, you have all the paperwork for you now. You have the fiscal impact, which is a no expenditure impact. And then you also have a revenue impact statement, which is a minimal impact, a revenue gain of less than $50,000 per biennium. And basically there, the assumption was that overall taxpayer behavior for contributions wouldn't really change. It would just be redirected from these organizations, the ones that are potentially affected by the bill, to other organizations. And there'd be some small amount of leakage, I guess, in terms of some people who actually wouldn't move their contributions. So it's a minimal revenue impact.
Okay. And then at this time, we've already had our public hearing, but I got an email from the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. We had been considering raising the threshold from 30% to maybe 40%. I got an email that very thoughtfully encourages us to stick with the lower number. We can always change it in the future after we see what happens with experience. But I'm going to enter that into the record. It's from Mary Lou and Ross Blayburn. And then I also have an email that I got in opposition from none other than the Direct Marketing Association's Nonprofit Federation. These are the folks who do telemarketing, and they're opposed to the bill. So, for those in the record, are there any questions from the committee, or we have people from the Attorney General's office in the audience if we need them? Senator Telford.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I have been a supporter of this bill, and so it would be nice to see if the Department of Justice has any knowledge as to whether this is constitutionally okay regarding the discrimination. I don't know if I'd call it that, but the spending formulas.
They did address that during the hearing, but let's have them recap that since we just got this.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Grant. I'm an Assistant Attorney General and manage the Charitable Activities section at the Department of Justice. And I understand the question is whether the proposed legislation, SB 40, is constitutional. We believe that it is. Unlike the legislation that was at issue back in the 80s that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on that raised constitutional concerns, in this case, this legislation does not bar any organization from soliciting. It merely ends the subsidies that are provided to inefficient and abusive organizations. And we think that that's the distinction that will make a difference, and that's why we believe this legislation to be constitutional, because the legislation before was a complete prohibition on solicitation, so that if you fell below the threshold, the organization was prohibited from soliciting at all, which is not what this legislation does.
Okay. And then the other point in here was that the allegation is that it unconstitutionally compels speech. Did you consider that in your analysis?
We don't believe that the yes, we did, Madam Chair. We don't believe that the speech at issue, there is a disclosure about whether tax deductibility exists or not. But we don't think that's the sort of compelled speech that is prohibited by the Supreme Court cases. For example, the Supreme Court cases have held, for example, that a solicitor can be required to disclose their professional solicitation status, that they are a professional solicitor. And similarly, 501c4 organizations already have to make disclosures that contributions to those organizations are not tax deductible. So we think it's the prerogative and the ability of the state to require disclosures that relate to tax deductibility without being considered improper compelled speech.
And to get to the bottom line on this, there's nothing in this bill that would prevent somebody from contributing to a charity. They simply would not be eligible for a tax deduction if this threshold is not met. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Tilford.
But just in the state of Oregon?
We're not trying to tell the IRS whether something should be in the Pub 78 or not.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct, that they would still get the federal deduction. It would just be in Oregon that they wouldn't get the benefit of a state income tax deduction.
Okay. And while you're here, there was some discomfort expressed by people that I talked to over the documentation requirement for taxpayers. Is there any change? Does this bill change in any way the documentation that taxpayers have to maintain in the normal course of taking a deduction?
Well, most taxpayers maintain that sort of documentation. They maintain receipts or acknowledgments from the charity. And for deductions that are in for contributions of over $250, they're required to maintain a written acknowledgement from the organization. So in some cases for donations that are smaller than that, they could have a check as proof of that they made that. So it's possible that a donor could somehow not have kept that acknowledgement and use a check to establish the deduction. I think if that issue came up in the course of an audit, they would be able to go back to the charity and say, can you give me what the written acknowledgement that you received? And then they could show that to the Department of Revenue as proof that they didn't get that disclosure. But I think in most cases, there really isn't that much of an additional burden on donors here. And we want them to know who they're donating to. I think in general, donors are expected to have some knowledge that they're donating to a qualified organization. And in this case, this would not be a qualified organization, and that information would be publicly available.
Okay, and so, but this really wouldn't even come up unless the taxpayer was audited. And if you found a charity that you wanted to take some action against, that wouldn't necessarily involve auditing all the taxpayers that contributed to that charity, would you?
That's correct. Our office would not be involved in auditing the donors that contributed it. And the focus of our office would be on the organization that wasn't making a proper disclosure. So we would like to know from donors that if they got a receipt that didn't have that disclosure and they subsequently learned that it was a disqualified organization, we would hope that those donors would contact our office and report that, because that would be a law violation. But with respect to how a donor might be impacted by this legislation, presumably they would be impacted because they would know in the beginning that they got the disclosure that this organization was not, donations to it were not tax deductible. So presumably with that disclosure, then they would act however they chose to act based upon that information. If they gave, even knowing that that information was true, then they should have, they would be paying taxes on that donation. They wouldn't get the tax deductibility. If for somehow, if they were audited and it was discovered they didn't have any written acknowledgement and the donation was less than $250, then there would be alternatives for the person to try to get that acknowledgement from the company that it didn't have tax deductibility. I mean, it might raise questions of that. But in general, all donors have to keep some financial information about the donations that they're making in order to take those tax deductions.
Senator Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Internal Revenue grants tax-exempt status, not the state of Oregon. Do you see this bumping up against Internal Revenue Code in that we aren't recognizing certain tax-exempt status? I do know there is an area on the 990 and the 990EZ that asks, did you donate money to somebody who was not tax exempt? So I guess there's a way to get around or get to that. But do you see a problem with the state of Oregon bumping up against the Internal Revenue that actually grants the tax exempt status?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we don't believe that is a problem. There are instances in which state tax law differs from federal tax law, as I'm sure you're all aware. And say, for example, in the case of property taxes, many times states are collecting property taxes on a charity that is exempt from IRS taxes, is tax exempt. And there's also a distinction between what's tax exempt and what's tax deductible. So these organizations would still remain tax exempt on a federal and a state level. So this is only changing one small part, which is the tax deductibility of the donations. And we think that the state is entitled to regulate that tax deductibility. They're not required to adopt the IRS standards that relate to tax deductibility.
We have Deborah here if you need further clarification. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question I would raise, and that has to do with the scope of responsibility between the Attorney General and the Department of Revenue. Would this be the first departure allowing the Attorney General to write rules for matters of revenue and tax?
I think you're just talking about a disclosure in this, correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's, I think our part is just the disclosure language.
It describes to the Department of Justice the disqualification.
Well, that's correct, yeah.
Right.
Deborah, come on up here.
To me, it raises an issue of whether we're starting down a road that maybe is not the best place. I'm supportive of the bill. I do have some concerns about the 30%, whether that's the right number, but whether the correct administration of this policy would reside in the Department of Justice or in the Department of Revenue. And, is this groundbreaking, so to speak, in this bill?
Deborah, you're on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Morris, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Senator Morris, to your specific question, I do note that the rulemaking on page 3 of the bill in Section 5 is for the Attorney General to adopt rules necessary for implementation of Sections 2 to 5, which I read to be the qualifications for the organization and the restrictions on the organization. The disallowance of a deduction, a tax deduction, is in Sections 6 through 9, and that is with the Department of Revenue. So I do see it as two separate provisions existing in the law, one for them to determine whether or not an entity is disqualified from accepting tax-deductible contributions, and then for the Department of Revenue to administer the deductibility of contributions for tax purposes.
Exactly.
Do you see a problem here?
Madam Chair, I do not see any particular problem with the bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you for bringing that up. Senator House, do you have any comments on this?
I'm still upset with the telemarketers. they have their people, too.
Well,
Senator Telfer.
Yesterday I did 6 CT-12s in my office in Bend, and I can tell you this 30%, a lot of it is just because they don't know what they're doing when it comes to the functional classification of expenses between program, fundraising, and administration. They just don't get it, and so you have to show clients. So some of them may not get to the 30%, but it's because of their lack of knowledge on how to account for it. But my understanding, though, is in talking with the Attorney General on this, that there's going to be some assistance offered to nonprofits so that they can know the proper way to account for the functional classification, whether it's something's program, administration, or fundraising, so a lot of them don't bump up against this 30% because they're just doing it out of ignorance, I guess, is the most pleasant way I can say it. So is that correct that you were anticipating the Department of Justice, who oversees nonprofits in this state, 501c3s, to offer some assistance to nonprofits so that they do account for these dollars?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Telfer. We would, if we saw a situation, in all of these situations by organizations that might potentially be disqualified, I think we would contact them and let them know about the threshold and about what their forms are looking like. I think it's fairly easy to tell when somebody has just inadvertently not allocated properly versus when they're allocating the way they are because the accounting rules require that allocation. So I would expect that we would contact those charities or contact, if they had assistance of a CPA, contact the CPA and said, and consult with them about whether, you know, if an allocation is that low, if it's appropriate or not. And in some ways, I think this is sort of this would be kind of a public service for those charities because the public is looking at those forms, and if those allocations are not appropriate, it can have an impact on the public's view of the organization, and we wouldn't want that to happen on the basis of there being sort of incorrect information out there.
And the point you raise is exactly why, I mean, because 30% when I was talking to people in my caucus about it, you know, there was 30%. That is so low. But when people account, like especially the smaller nonprofits, they don't necessarily have CPAs who can tell them, well, you take this much of your salaries and allocate to program and so on. They're not that sophisticated. So that made me more comfortable about going with the lower number.
Well, and if I may, you know, many nonprofits, 501c3s in the early years may have a lot of administration and fundraising as they're, you know, trying to, but this is once every 3 years. I mean, this is not just looking at 1 year in a vacuum. It is looking at the trend, so to speak. And, the public or the support test is always done based on facts and circumstances, so at the IRS level. So I would imagine we'll still be looking at support tests with facts and circumstance basis.
Okay. Senator Morris.
I think the issue that you're talking about, Senator Telfer, is the program services definition. Mm-hmm. Who makes that definition by this statute? And it references the filing of the 990 for the total expenses, and it's a ratio of program services to that total. But who makes that determination? And how will it be made? I don't see that program services is defined in any way. And that's where I'm concerned about the rulemaking of the AG's office getting into tax matters.
Well, let me see. I won't bill you for this. This is normally what...
Give us a tutorial.
Number one, the Attorney General's office does oversee nonprofits. The Department of Revenue deals with the donation from the donor and the deductibility of it. So the Attorney General is in, rightfully the one that oversees this. And the answer to the definition of program versus supporting services as fundraising and administration are a little, it's not black and white. It's very difficult. A lot of it depends on the nonprofit as to how they see, is this a fundraising? If you send out a newsletter, for instance, you could say, well, that's program. Well, it's only program if there's a call to action. Otherwise, it could be fundraising, it could be administration, it could be, I mean, we've got where you can take your newsletter and add up the words, and you can say, well, 10% of the words are fundraising, 20% of the words have to do with call to action. I mean, it gets very complicated as far as allocating those expenses. Some are pretty easy, direct to the program, direct to administration, or direct to fundraising, but some of them are not easy to identify.
And it's my understanding that the purpose in bringing this forward is to not go after those gray areas ones, but to go after ones. You have a limited enforcement capability. And it's my understanding that the Attorney General wants to go after the worst of the worst on these.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's right. That part of the reason why the threshold is so low is to stay away from any area that might be gray. And we have relatively little discretion under the bill to change, to come up with a different number for program services than the organization has identified. So our discretion is very limited, and it really is to get at the worst of the worst, as you say.
But if you see a telemarketer calling into Oregon and taking 80% of the proceeds that never get to the organization, that would be a pretty clear-cut case that of someone you'd be interested in going after.
Madam Chair, yes. And right now, we don't necessarily have the ability to go after that organization if they're not making any false statements. But with this legislation, we would be able to take some action against that organization.
All right. I think we've discussed this quite a bit. Senator Morse, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 40 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morse has moved Senate Bill 40 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any more discussion? I have one little piece of discussion, and that is this bill, I think, is a good tool for the Attorney General, but this is no substitute for donors to worthy causes to do their due diligence in researching the organizations that they're giving to. I personally would be very unhappy if giving to an organization where I thought they were only spending 30% on the cause that was important to me, and I don't think this takes the donors off the hook. So that's my comment. All right, any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, does anybody want to carry this? I'll carry it then. And that completes our work for the day. We are adjourned. That completes our work for the day. We are adjourned.